listening to Dallas Theological Seminary's Chapel Podcast.
Let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Kreider. This is just a little soundbite here, but Dr. Kreider identifies his motivations as his passion for the triune God and his desire to help others respond to divine revelation in spirit and in truth. And prior to coming to DTS, he directed Christian education and pastored a church over in Cedar Hill. He is married to Janice. They have two children. Dr. Kreider's research interests include Jonathan Edwards, theological method, and our eschatological hope. So let's welcome Dr. Glenn Kreider as he comes.
Grace. It's a name for a girl. It's also a thought that could change the world. Grace travels outside of karma. Grace finds beauty in ugly things. Grace finds beauty in everything. Grace finds goodness in everything. This little book, familiar to most of you, What's So Amazing About Grace, Philip Yancey talks about the problem of defining grace, and he proposes as a definition that grace means that there is nothing we can do to make God love us more and nothing we can do to make God love us less. St. Augustine in the Confessions seems to have captured the essence of grace when he says to God, "Give what you command and command what you will." Very similarly stated by Sandra McCracken in her song, Grace Upon Grace, where she says in the refrain, "All that you ask, your grace will provide." We are dependent upon grace. We are dependent upon God's grace. C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity says, and I'm quoting, "When we talk of a man doing anything for God or giving anything to God, I'll tell you what it's really like. It's like a small child going to his father and saying, 'Daddy, give me sixpence to buy you a birthday present.' Of course, the father does, and he is pleased with the child's present. It's all very nice and proper, but only an idiot would think that the father is sixpence to the good on the transaction." End quotation. In short, the father is sixpence, none the richer. Having provided the means for the purchase of the gift, he is the recipient of his own gift. He has, as it were, purchased his own presence. But he is no less pleased with the gift his son has given, because the son doesn't have anything to provide for his father. He is dependent upon his father's grace. Grace is unmerited favor. It is a thought that could change the world. It's unlikely that there's anyone in this room who would argue with anything I said to this point. There might be a person or two who's offended that I used the word idiot. I remind you that I was quoting C.S. Lewis. Surely people who have been recipients of God's grace, who have received the grace of God in the gospel, who are at Dallas Seminary, a place known for grace, who are preparing for ministry of grace, understand and appreciate God's grace. Of course we do. Yet I suspect that the law of karma, the law of sowing and reaping, is so deeply embedded in our world and so deeply embedded in us that to a great extent we're really not even familiar with how much of the way we view the world is through the lens of karma instead of through the lens of grace. At least I know that's true of me. I suspect that grace might be a little like humility. Beware of those who think they've mastered it. Story is widely told, and my version comes from Chuck Swindoll's Grace Awakening, that near the end of his life, about 3 months before his death in 1952, Lewis Berry Chafer, in a classroom at the end of the class session, went over and turned off the lights, and there was, from the crowd, from the male students, and they were all male at the time, the students in the classroom, that there was an ovation for him. And according to an eyewitness in the room, Dr. Chafer wheeled his wheelchair around and with tears in his eyes said, "Gentlemen, for over half my life, I've been studying this truth, and I'm just beginning to understand, or just beginning rather, to discover what the grace of God is all about." The founder of Dallas Seminary, after decades of teaching and preaching and writing on grace, 3 months before his death, said, "I'm only beginning to discover what the grace of God is all about." I have a very, very simple goal today, and that is to encourage a lifelong pursuit of the understanding of grace. And as a means to do that, I'd like to look at a story in Scripture, the story of Solomon in 1 Kings chapter 3. I will be reading today from the English Standard Version, 1 Kings chapter 3. In order to set the context, let me read the last verse of 1 Kings chapter 2. So the kingdom was established in the hand of Solomon. The kingdom has been established. Solomon's enemies have been destroyed. They've been killed. David's last enemy has been destroyed. Solomon's brothers have been marginalized. A couple of them have been killed. The kingdom is now firmly established in Solomon's hands. And the narrator tells us in verse 1 that Solomon made a marriage alliance with the Pharaoh, king of Egypt. He took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her into the city of David until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. This is not Solomon's first wife, and it won't be his last. The narrator doesn't say anything about whether his taking this wife is a good thing or a bad thing or not, but certainly, by the time we get to the end of Solomon's life, and he has 699 more, that's probably one or two too many. And the people were sacrificing at the high places, however, because no house had yet been built in the name of the Lord. And Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of David his father, except, and that except, it seems to me, is fairly significant. Again, the narrator doesn't do a great deal. It doesn't call our attention to it. But I think there's a pretty strong implicit indication that Solomon's behavior is not acceptable to God. It's not pleasing to God. That Solomon loved the Lord. He walked in the statutes of David, his father, except for this. He sacrificed and made offerings at the high places. And at particularly one of those high places, the king went to Gibeon. Why? Because that was the most significant high place. And there, Solomon offered regularly, he used to offer, 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. One thing we know about Solomon, he is hyperbole incarnate. If one sacrifice is good, 50 would be better, but Solomon doesn't stop with 50, 1,000. Regularly. He does the same thing, I remind you, with his wives. 700 wives is not enough for him. He needs 300 concubines. Those are friends with benefits. In addition to... And at Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream. Apparently, God was really impressed with Solomon, was really impressed with all Solomon's offerings. Submit to you, that's what Solomon thought, and that's the problem. The Lord appeared to him in a dream by night, and God said, "Ask what I shall give you." And Solomon said, "You have shown great and steadfast love to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in faithfulness, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart toward you. And you have kept this great and steadfast love, have given him a son to sit on his throne this day. And now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of David my father. Although I am but a little child, I don't know how to go out or come in. But your servant is in the midst of your people whom you have chosen, a great people, too many to be numbered or counted for multitude. So give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind, to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to govern this great people? And it pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this. And God said to him, because you have asked this, and have not asked for yourself long life or riches or the life of your enemies, and have asked for yourself understanding to discern what is right, behold, I now do according to your word. Behold, I give you a wise and discerning mind, so that none like you shall arise after you. I give you also what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that no other king shall compare with you all your days. And if you will walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and my commandments as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your days. And Solomon awoke, and behold, it was a dream. And he came to Jerusalem and stood before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, again, a not-so-subtle indication that his offering sacrifices at Gibeon was probably not a good idea, and offered up burnt offerings and peace offerings and made a feast for all his servants. Solomon has the incredible opportunity. God comes to him and says, what do you want from me? I'll give you whatever you ask. It's every person's dream. And Solomon chooses wisdom. And God gives him wisdom. God gives him, in addition to wisdom, God gives him riches and honor. And so that there will be none wiser than Solomon, no king wiser than Solomon, no one wiser than Solomon who ever lived. And the students at Dallas Seminary, you know that's not the end of the story, because this wisest man who ever lived became the biggest fool who ever lived. That might be hyperbole, not by much. This is what Solomon does. Flip over to chapter 11 if you want to read it for yourself. Don't do that now. What Solomon does is break every single one of God's commands and warnings directed to the kings. He adds to himself many wives from among the Canaanites and everyone else, and he begins to worship their gods. This is the wisest man who ever lived becomes an incredible fool. Remember what God had said? If you obey me, if you remain faithful, I will give you long life. So what do we expect to happen to Solomon? We expect that Solomon will die young, and he doesn't. It's probably just a coincidence that Saul and David and Solomon all reigned exactly the same length of time. The rejected King Saul reigns 40 years. A man after God's own heart, the chosen King David, reigns 40 years. And Solomon, the wisest fool who ever lived, reigns exactly 40 years. I suspect God's making a point there, lest people think that somehow the length of reign had something to do with the king and the character of the king. You say, well, but didn't God say, if you do this, then I will do that? Mm-hmm. And Solomon didn't, and still received what God had offered. It is my conviction, or it is at least my suspicion, that one contributing factor to Solomon's incredible foolishness is that Solomon, from the very beginning of his life, failed to get it. It is my suspicion that one contributing factor to Solomon's incredible stupidity is that Solomon, from the beginning of his life, did not get it. I suspect that Solomon thought God was impressed by the number of sacrifices he made. Let me insert here a little parenthesis, and most commentators are too. It's stunning to me to read the commentaries on 1 Kings 3 who point out that the reason why God appeared to Solomon and offered him whatever he wanted was because God was impressed with all of the sacrifices. Just think about that for a second. You recognize the problem. I suspect that one of the contributing factors, not the only one, but one of the contributing factors to Solomon's incredible foolishness is that Solomon never got it. Did you hear it? Just to be sure you didn't hear that, that you did hear it, go back to 1 Kings 3, verse 6. God said to Solomon in verse 5, "Ask what I shall give you." And Solomon says in verse 6, "You have shown great and steadfast love, loyal love, covenant love, chesed. You have shown great and steadfast love to your servant David, my father, because." It doesn't matter what Solomon says after because. Whatever he says after because is affirming the law of karma, not the law of grace. And whatever he says after because indicates that there is some reason why God has done what he has done, in which case God is now obligated and it is not by grace. But here's what he says. "You have shown great loyal love to David because he walked before you in faithfulness." Oh, yeah? "In righteousness." Oh, yeah? "And in uprightness of heart toward you." You hear the irony in there? If Solomon had been right, there would have been no Solomon. And that's the point. Let me belabor the point just to make sure you got it. Had David walked in faithfulness to God and faithfulness to his many wives, there would have never been that affair with Bathsheba. There never would have been Solomon. Had David walked in righteousness, there never would have been that affair with Bathsheba. There never would have been Solomon. And had he walked in uprightness of heart toward God, there never would have been that affair with Bathsheba. There never would have been Solomon. I suspect one of the contributing factors to Solomon's incredible foolishness is that Solomon didn't get it. That he thought the grace of God could be earned, could be merited, could be bought. If grace is unmerited favor, then it is favor that is unmerited. If it can be merited, then it's karma, and it's not grace. In his book called Walk On, Steve Stockman says, "There is something about grace that makes even those who believe in it find it hard to believe in. You can hear the words and take hold of the understanding that here is an upside-down world order where the first are last and the last are first, and where acceptance is unmerited, in a world where the first are first, and the only way to be affirmed is to be the most intelligent or best looking or most successful, it is hard to get reconditioned to the conditioning of grace. A flower doesn't bloom in 1 hour of sunlight, and a believer's soul needs constant exposure to the rays of grace, day after day, year after year, before it moves from an intellectual assent to a truth that our lives bask in and live by." I suspect that one of the contributing factors to Solomon's incredible foolishness is that Solomon didn't get it. If you get it, it'll help you avoid the same kind of foolishness that Solomon manifested. Gracious God, I ask that we who are recipients of your grace would be increasingly more and more appreciative of its power to change the world, and that we would be agents of that grace to the glory of your name. Amen.